Hello, my darlings, and welcome back to the Bathtub Mermaid Tales from the Tub. I'm Miss Melisse, and tonight I have not just one story, but three. Threads of salt and myth, memory and resistance, woven from sea and sky. We'll begin with the queen on the waves and a lieutenant among the stars. We'll slip next into the bay that pretends to bless but always demands her price. And finally, we'll meet the phantom of the Anklot, bound to a mermaid's bargain, forever turning storms aside. So sink back, let the water lap at your shoulders, and listen. Free women of sea and stars. Names matter. They carry echoes, shadows, and histories, even when the person wearing the name doesn't know it. Sometimes a name is a promise. Sometimes it's a burden. And sometimes it's a signal across centuries, like a call and response that was never supposed to happen, but does anyway. Sayida al-Hurra's name meant the free woman. She was born Laya Ayaka bint Ali ibn Rashid al-Alami in 1485 in Morocco. By the time she took the throne of Tetuan after her husband's death, the name Sayida al-Hurra had become both a title and a declaration. She was the free woman, the noble lady, the one who owed allegiance to no man. She ruled not as a placeholder or regent, but in her own right. She governed the city, commanded fleets, and wielded political alliances like weapons. She struck a partnership with the famed Ottoman corsair Barbarossa, and together they turned the Mediterranean into a stage for their power. Her ships raided Portuguese and Spanish vessels, reclaiming wealth stolen from North Africa and striking fear into colonial powers that had assumed the sea belonged to them. In a world where women were expected to remain invisible, domestic, cloistered, silent, she carved her name across the waves. Not as a wife, not as a consort, as herself. Freedom was never handed to Sayida al-Hurra. She seized it, ship by ship, raid by raid, decree by decree. Centuries later, in a television studio in 1960s Los Angeles, another woman bore a name that also meant freedom. Niota Uhura, the communications officer on the Starship Enterprise. Her surname came from the Swahili word, Uhuru, freedom. Her first name, Niota, meant star, freedom among the stars. When Nichelle Nichols first appeared on screen in that red uniform, calm and authoritative at the communications console, she was a revelation. A black woman not in the background, not a maid or a comic foil, but a respected officer on the bridge of a starship, working alongside men of every race and nationality. At a time when segregation was still raw and civil rights marches filled the streets, her presence on Star Trek was more than casting. It was a statement. Martin Luther King Jr. famously urged Nichols not to leave the show when she considered quitting, reminding her that she was shaping the image of what the future could look like. And she stayed, not just as a performer, but as a symbol. Uhura was proof that the future was wide enough for women, for black women, for voices that had been excluded for far too long. Sayida al-Hurra ruled the seas. Niota Uhura navigated the stars. Both were free women who claimed spaces where the world didn't expect to see them. And maybe that's why their names feel like a call and response across centuries. One woman staring down colonial empires with cannons, the other calling through darkness and connecting people with her voice. One a queen commanding fleets, the other an officer commanding language itself, translating chaos into order, holding her crew together with words. Both of them remind us that freedom isn't something handed down politely. It isn't permission or a token seat at the table. It's something fought for, taken, and lived in. The parallels between sea and sky are older than either woman. Mariners have always looked to the stars for guidance. Conquerors, dreamers, and wanderers have always compared the unknown ocean to the uncharted cosmos. The sea is a mirror for the sky, and the sky is a mirror for the sea. Sayida al-Hurra's fleets cut across one, while Uhura's voice bridged the other. Both women commanded liminal spaces, places that belong to no one and everyone, places that promised freedom and danger in equal measure. And both carried names that told the world exactly who they were, free women. In our own moment, their stories intertwine as more than trivia. They are reminders of possibility. When I hear Saida al-Hurra's name, I hear the echo of resistance, a woman who refused to be silenced, who claimed her right to rule, who struck fear into empires. When I hear Nyota Uhura's name, I hear the promise of representation, a woman who stood on the bridge of the future, showing us that all freedom could mean equality, visibility, dignity, belonging. Sea and stars, Corsair Queen and Starship Queen. And perhaps it isn't only coincidence, but a hidden continuity. As if Uhura were, in some imagined genealogy, the descendant of Saida al-Hurra herself, a free woman of the seas, reborn among the stars, carrying forward the legacy of command, defiance, and freedom in a new frontier. From freedom on the seas and freedom among the stars, we now turn to waters closer to shore, where blessing and curse are the same tide. The bay that storms forgets. The gulf is too hot this year. The water feels heavy, the air thick with it. And yet summer has nearly passed without a single storm. No spirals spinning on the maps, no frantic rush for plywood or bottled water, just stillness. And stillness is never safe. My grandmother used to say the bay was blessed. She would tell me stories about covenants whispered into the tide, or a princess buried in the water with her drowned warriors guarding her rest. And when the storm spun wide and furious, only to curve away at the last moment, she would nod and say, "See? The bay protects her own." I believed her, until I met Daniel. He was a fisherman, older than me, his skin the color of weathered rope, his eyes always turned toward the horizon. He said the bay wasn't blessed at all. "She is beautiful," he told me once, "but beauty like that always takes something back." He'd lost a brother to a calm sea. No warning, no storm, just a boat that never came home. "The bay feeds on us," he said, "and that's why the storms don't stay." I didn't know what to make of it. Not then. But I remembered when Daniel himself vanished. Clear skies, flat water, he never returned. The Coast Guard called it an accident. His family called it bad luck. But I knew. The bay had reached for him the way a jealous lover reaches, and she had kept him. That's when I understood what my grandmother never said out loud. Spared doesn't mean safe. The storms still circle. They pace the horizon like wolves, throwing their weight against the gulf. When they reach the bay, they falter. They turn aside. And every time they do, another village farther up the coast is torn apart. Another marsh is drowned. Another name is added to the roll of the lost. People here still call it a blessing. They laugh about the bubble. Say the storms never land. Pour another drink while they patch their roofs. But I think about Daniel, about his brother, about all the others the bay has claimed when the skies were calm. The bay doesn't protect us for free. She takes her payment in flesh and memory. Now, the summer is nearly gone. The air feels too quiet, the water too still, like everything is holding its breath. Maybe the storms will try again soon. Maybe the bay will sing them aside as she always does. Maybe she'll ask for another offering first. And you know how these stories go. There's always a storm. There's always a price. Stillness, storms, and bargains. Our waters are never free. Which brings us to one more debt. One more haunting. A phantom ship, sails glowing on the Enclode, a man kept by the sea. This is the Enclode Phantom and the Mermaid's Debt. They say the first time you see the phantom, you'll think it's just moonlight. The sails glow a little. The water does that trick it does in August or September when the plankton get feisty and every wake turns into handwriting. green cursive trailing the sterns of weekend boats, kids shrieking like they did something magical instead of biological. From the sponge docks, the laughter carries, the bouzouki from Hellas blends with gull screech and outboard chatter, and everyone pretends summer will last forever. But the glow the phantom throws is older than summer and sharper. It isn't party light. It's warning. I should know. I grew up on the Enclote, where the river slides out past salt marsh and mangrove to find herself a proper horizon. My grandmother kept a clapboard house on pilings and a radio that wasn't for music. Weather only, she'd say, tapping the speaker like it owed her rent. Storms are company and you don't ignore company. She told me the story the way some families say grace, with gratitude, with a touch of dread, always in order. Once upon a shoreline, there was a pirate who didn't want to be a pirate anymore. His name had prayed. Some people said Captain Ionis. Others made it English, Jonas. And my grandmother, who never met a vowel she couldn't bend, called him Yanni. He'd raided up and down the gulf until his soul felt pickled. The coin piled in his cabin made a misery of him. It tanged like rust. It weighed like sleep. On the day he tried to leave it, his men tied him to the mast for disloyalty, and the gulf spread its flat face for him like a mirror he refused to look in. The storm that found him wasn't much. Not yet. Just a bruise on the sky. The gulf getting ideas. White caps with good teeth. It would have passed. Florida storms always say one thing and do another. Except the shoals off Enclote were hungry, and the tide miscounted herself. And the ship kissed sand hard enough to bite through. That's when the mermaids surface. Do not picture Disney. No clamshells, no bashful hair curtain. Picture a woman made of pressure and salt, her throat latticed with the faint pale scars of gill slits that open only when she sings. Picture a gaze like a cutlass, bright, unarguable. Her hair wasn't hair, it was the moving shade you find under mangroves when you think you're alone. She looked at Yanni first because he was tied to the mast and the mast was stubborn. She cocked her head and listened. That's the part everyone gets wrong. Mermaids don't smell your fear. They hear it, the tremor of it, the baseline in your blood. What do you want? She asked him. To live, he said, which was at least honest. And what will you give the water for that? She asked him, which was at least polite. Everything. He said, which was a mistake. His crew screamed when the hull buckled. He didn't. He just watched her. She slid closer. She reached up and laid two fingers on the rope that made a girdle of his chest. The knots went slack, like they were embarrassed to be caught at it. He stepped free and almost fell because the ship had listed, because the sea had opinions, because he had just chosen life without reading the contract. She cupped his jaw like a lover and kissed him. It tasted like the moment before the lightning strikes. Done, she said, and let go. The ship broke. The crew went into the green panic. Yanni did not drown. He did not even swallow water. He slid into the gulf like a second skin and found he did not sink and did not float and did not need anything so vulgar as air. The storm bruised past, sulking. The Enclote shoals let go of their new toy. By morning, the ship had become a rumor, and Yanni had become a story no one could tell correctly. Immortality sounds grand. It's not. It's being kept. He tried to go north. The current turned him sideways. He tried to go south. The eddies laughed him back. He swore and spat and pleaded and sang. He offered oaths that meant something and bribes that didn't. The mermaid did not come. The shoals did. The first time the phantom rose, people thought it was a trick of heat. Sails don't do that, someone said, meaning glow. But the sails did that. The ribs of the ship showed faintly through the white like bones in a good x-ray. The hull didn't mark the water so much as etch it. Wherever it went, the plankton woke and went to church. That was the point. Warnings are for the living. Yanni's debt was simple. Steer the storms away from the mouth of the river. Keep the sponge boat safe. Let Tarpon Spring sleep. The Gulf, cold patron that she is, makes deals all the time. She only asks for enforcement. Every season has a shape if you look, That year, the storms came like a pack, restless, lean. Each time one tried to nose past Encloak Key, the phantom cut across its face a slash of light on flat water. The storm would shiver, shoulder itself a few degrees east, and go off to teach Clearwater a lesson, or ravage the long beaches further down. People clapped the sand from their hands, grateful. The dock smelled like beer and diesel. My grandmother set a plate at the end of the table and said it was for the captain. She'd salted herself. She always salted his empty plate. She never went out when the sail showed. She wasn't foolish. You don't wave at a funeral, she said, even if it's someone else's. Of course, I waved. Of course, I went. I was 19 and reckless, and the Encloak at dusk makes you believe you are the center of a very generous map. My grandmother fell asleep in her rocker with the radio mumbling forecast, and I slid the skiff down the mud like a secret. The phantom was to the west, tracking the black seam of a storm that hadn't yet been born. The sky wore that hard yellow you only see when the sun has decided to be theatrical. I didn't aim at the ship. I'm not that much of a fool. But I wanted to be near it, to see if the bones were real. They were. So was he. He stood at the rail like the statue Evie Harbor once, chin lifted, coat moving in a wind I couldn't feel. He was not beautiful. He was an old man and a young one, layered like shale, time wrong-footed around him. When the bioluminescence caught his shadow, it threw a second ship alongside, quick as palming a card. "You don't belong here," he said. His voice landed in my chest like it had sailed there. "Neither do you," I said, because I was 19. He smiled the way men smile when they forgive you for being rude because it reminds them they were alive once. "I belong precisely here," he said. "That is the problem." "Does she ever come back?" I asked. "The one who kissed you?" More shadow than hand gripped the rail. For a second, the sea around the ship went dark, like all the tiny lights took a breath. "She comes," he said. "When the tide brings her, when the shoals are thirsty, when the world forgets to balance itself and I have to remind it." "That sounds lonely." "It's a job." "What happens if you refuse?" I asked. He looked toward the river like it was a child sleeping. "Then the storm comes in." "I'm not asking if it's necessary," I said. "I'm asking what happens to you." He looked at me then, found the measure of me, decided to spend the truth on me like coin. "I drown," he said, "and wake up on my deck and do it again." The first drop of rain hit my cheek like punctuation. The line between sea and sky erased itself. My skiff rocked a little, eager to make this into a mistake. I thought of my grandmother, salt on an empty plate. I thought of the men at the docks who lived on tips and weather, of the kids who would grow up and pretend not to believe because pretending is a kind of armor. "I could help you," I blurted, and had no plan to add to it. He laughed. It was a surprisingly soft sound. "You would throw your life against a promise a king could not break," he said. "Keep your life. Spend it well." The rain found its rhythm. The phantom eased between me and the mouth of the river, a bright, impossible knife. The storm shouldered us like we were furniture to be rearranged. I rode the chop back, swearing I would not look over my shoulder, then breaking that promise three times because I am exactly the kind of woman who breaks that promise three times. From shore, the phantom looked smaller. That's how safety always looks, insufficient until it works. My grandmother didn't scold me. She handed me a towel and said another place. The radio said the storm had veered east. The mermaid, if she came, came without ceremony. The tide climbed the pilings and combed her hair with eelgrass. I kept the secret of Yanni's face like a pearl I wasn't sure how to wear. I finished school. I came back. I left again. Hurricanes introduced themselves, each with a fresh name and the same old hunger. The phantom lit the water like a final candle. The storms curved and went to break something that wasn't us. On Sundays, I salted the plate. Last year, when the Gulf ran a fever and the fish started floating belly up like coins with the wrong monarch stamped on them, I went back to the docks. The tourists still took pictures with the bronze diver. The fishermen still cursed softly in Greek. The sky had gone that color again, that yellow that pries open a mouth. The phantom rose before the first advisory. No one else seemed to see it. Maybe eyes learned to slide off certain truths. Maybe Grace's angles. I borrowed the skiff out of habit and regret. The river wore its pretty face. Girls in cotton dresses, boys with shotgun smiles. I pushed past them like a rude prayer. Out in the channel, the current clawed at the hull with the determined affection of a cat. I didn't get as close this time. Didn't need to. He was there. He is always there. "You came back," he said. "You always knew I would," I said. "We don't leave our dead alone." He gestured at the shoals. The water there boiled politely. "I am not dead." "That's the problem," I said, and surprised us both with the anger in it. He tilted his head, listening to something I couldn't hear. Maybe her. Maybe the river learning a new word. He took off his hat, black, wrong century, wrong world, and bowed the kind of bow that says I learned manners where they were weapon and art both. When he lifted his head, his eyes had gone colorless as rain. "Would you like to see it?" he asked. "See what?" "The contract." The mermaid rose without breaking the surface. That's the best way I can say it. The light changed. The water around the phantom went from green to the blue you taste behind your teeth when you've swum too long. A shape. A shadow. Not a woman, but not a woman. If holiness has cousins, she is a first cousin. She did not look at me. I know, because if she had, I wouldn't be telling this. She looked only at him. "Payment," she whispered, and the river bent toward her like a reed. He stood very straight. He did not look at me either. Maybe that was his kindness. Maybe that was mine. "Go home," he said. I started. "You could drown," he said, and smiled that soft, infuriating smile, and turned toward the open gulf where the line of the storm had thickened into a wall. I did as I was told this one time in my life. I went home. I salted the plate. The radio spoke in that calm voice that knows the difference between panic and information. The storm turned. It flooded streets with names I grew up saying. It tore a hole through neighborhoods that had never learned to fear water. It left us with our roofs intact and our gratitude loud. We said things like miracle and luck. We did not say debt. We did not say kept. At dawn, when the shrimpers went out to check their luck and count their boats, one skiff found the shoals shallow as bone. Phantom was not there. The water glowed tiredly like a saint after a long day. I went to the river with coffee and an apology and watched mullet throw themselves in the air like they could fix gravity with enthusiasm alone. The Phantom came back that night. Of course he did. That's the contract. He will be there tomorrow, too. Unless he won't. The Gulf always wins. Not today is the best Florida can hope for. Sometimes, late, I walk the edge of the docks and listen for a voice that never learned how to be unkind. When the tide is right and the sky forgets to lie, I leave a pinch of salt on the rail and thank the kept man who keeps us. I thank the woman who wrote him into the water and never learned how to unwish a thing. I thank the river for taking the shape of the grace we ask for and the grace we deserve. From certain angles, the sails look like wings. From certain angles, they look like teeth. And from the right spot, on the right night, if you squint past the glow and the gulls and your own disbelief, you can see the kiss still shining on his mouth like lightning lag, bright, terrible, binding, while he turns the storm aside for us again. 3 stories tonight, my loves, of women who claim their freedom, of a bay that spares but never saves, and of a phantom who carries the weight of a mermaid's kiss. Thank you for sharing your time in the tub with me. Until next time, bubbles fade, but voices don't. Keep swimming and resist.
Content for the Bathtub Mermaid Tales from the Tub is written and produced by Melissa A. Bartel and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike 4.0 International License. No one does anything entirely alone. Join me in thanking my patrons, Nuke Chuss, Susan Fogel, Jason Banks, Clay Robeson, Charlotte and Ken Kennedy, Mark, the Encaffeinated One, Selena Taylor, Fran Hutchinson, and Patricia.
You too can become part of my supporters roll call for as little as $1 a month. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/bathtubmermaid and subscribe.
For show notes and complete credits, visit bathtubmermaid.com.